Good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Jonathan Melton. I'm the chaplain at St. Francis House, the Episcopal Student Center at UW-Madison. Go Badgers. And many of you have heard me say that before, because also last year I had the wonderful privilege of getting to know many of you for a semester, spending my mornings here and my evenings on campus. It is just a really wonderful gift and joy to be with you this morning. With my good friend, Father Don, with Dr. Eastman, Jim Eastman, who's a board member, other friends, and so many of you Camp Webb friends. Like, this is so great. I was thinking as we were singing that sequence hymn, with strangers now our friends, this thing that happens as we gather in the Eucharist, and St. Luke's for me and for the St. Francis House community, truthfully, is really grateful for the friendship that the gospel has meant for us. So it's a joy to be with you this morning. I appeal to you, therefore, brothers and sisters, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual worship. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your minds, so that you may discern what is the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect. The Danish philosopher Soren Kierkegaard liked to tell the story of a man who owned a shop. Shop was something like a general store, and one day it got late and the shopkeeper did what shopkeepers do. He put things in order and he called it a day. He closed shop and went home. But sometime later that evening, or maybe even deeper into the night, some thieves broke into the shopkeeper's store. Bizarrely, the thieves, they didn't steal anything. Instead, catch this, they meticulously rearranged all the labels, the price labels, on the items in the store. So cheap things now had four-digit tags, and the really precious things were made to look cheap. The next day, the shopkeeper arrived at the store, and he didn't notice the hoax. Nothing appeared to be any less in order than it had the night before. From the shopkeeper's perspective, protected from critical reflection by the mundaneness of the rhythms of life, this was just another day. Then the customers started arriving. They didn't notice anything out of the ordinary. Instead, all of them began interacting, shopping, purchasing, exactly as they had on the day before, but with the labels as they now were, as if the mislabeled labels reflected the true value of things. And they're still doing that now, still shopping in the store, not knowing that none of the labels are true. Kierkegaard says that our world is that shop. Cheap things get lifted up, they attract our time and sometimes our devotion. We sometimes attach our lives to these cheap things. We make too much of them. Meanwhile, truly precious things get mislabeled as cheap, and we dismiss them. We miss out on them. We don't think much about the things we should think more about. When we do, we don't think about them in a way that reflects their real worth and right place in the world. The labels have been put on the wrong things, and it is darn near impossible to know what anything is worth anymore. And yet, sometimes, against all odds in such a world, sometimes a person comes to her senses and peels back the label. Sometimes a person finds herself doing double takes between twin mismatched realities, and she thinks to herself, well, that can't be right. You peel off a label of a precious thing called cheap, and you decide to elevate its place in the world, no matter what the rest of the world says. You decide to elevate its place in your life. Likewise, you peel off the high-priced label off the really cheap thing, and make room in your life accordingly. These label rectifying moments, when they come, they are almost like miracles. So an MD, PhD student came to me at the start of a year, very much like this one a couple years back, and said, "Jonathan, I've realized something. I can be first in my class, and I can be. Or I can be a person who takes care of herself and those around her, engages the community of faith, nurtures her soul, and gets 9 hours of sleep every night. But I can't do both." And then she said, "Jonathan, I'm not sure being first in my class is worth what it will cost me. And I'm not even sure it will make me a better doctor in the end. I'm making the choice not to pay it." So true story, years later, I'm sitting at a table at this wedding reception, a mutual friend's wedding reception, with this student and her fiance. We're sharing the same table. And one of the other guests at the table, unknown to either of us before this day, says to this student out of the blue, You look so well rested." And I thought, who says that? I've never heard that compliment. Who goes around and says, "You look..." Maybe it's just me. Nobody says that to parents. But you look so rested. And I thought, how absurd. And yet, if anyone did deserve to have that said of them, it was this student. And maybe you have had one of these life relabeling moments yourself. Something you had thought was worth everything, you came to question or reevaluate. Another thing you hadn't valued much before suddenly emerges instead as precious and beautiful in your sight in a way you hadn't seen. And you know that from that moment, you will commit your life to that thing in a particular way. That is, you can already see the distance from where you are now to where the beauty of that thing will compel you and what it will cost you, and that is a price you are willing to pay, a sacrifice you are willing to make. You feel yourself to be on the edge of willing alterations to the ways you think about and move within this world. Ordinarily, such a prospect, such a cost would have been scary, if not terrifying, but instead you are energized by and made open to the possibility of the new thing you could be. Christians have historically called these moments conversions, when God moves us to bring our lives into line with true labels, the true value of things. And these conversions happen even from within a life of faith. It's not that the confusion is news, right? You might have suspected that something was up, that some of life's labels had been rearranged or swapped. The trick is discernment. Which ones go where? How to undo the mess and make things right. And we are here this morning in this space in part because we believe discernment is a team sport. Together, weekly, we open our hearts in the scriptures and we ask God to make our imagination more like God's imagination. We watch in the scriptures as Jesus pulls off the cheap labels off of people on the margins and puts those cheap labels on performances of prayer that are just for show. We marvel at so-called weak things like patience, generosity and vulnerability, gentleness, humility, self-giving and forgiving, and how these get raised up in this story, Jesus' story. They get raised up even above traditionally big-ticket items like power and wealth. Today's gospel is maybe one of the biggest band-aid-ripping, label-switching moments in the whole story of Jesus. They're in the region of Caesarea Philippi, Jesus and his disciples. And that place, you can look at the word, but it doesn't take the Bible, so I'm not Bible scholar, but it doesn't take one to figure out it's named after Caesar, right? The place where they are is named after Caesar, the emperor. They're standing near a temple named for the emperor, who sometimes goes by the title on his casual days, Son of the Living God. Sound familiar? In other words, Peter's answer to Jesus' question, "Who do you say that I am?" is about to get political. Peter is about to call Jesus a king. And the thing about calling certain people kings is that it can uncall other people kings. even when you don't say it directly, because when it comes to allegiance, you only have one pledge to give. But Jesus doesn't look much like a king, which maybe one theologian has observed that these days we ask the state to give us the things we used to pray and ask God for, because Jesus doesn't look very much like our ideas of king, which is why Jesus calls Peter's answer, Peter's attempt to rearrange the labels this morning. He calls it a miracle. Flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father in heaven. What does it mean to call, for Peter to call Jesus king? What does it mean for Peter to call Jesus the Messiah? To call someone like Jesus a king is a little bit like Peter's saying he found God's kingdom in the produce aisle just behind the bananas. It's not just that the kingdom's value has been mislabeled, like in Kierkegaard's store, in terms of value or worth. It's been misshelved altogether, because Jesus doesn't look like anything like the usual label called king. Kingdom labels play by the usual kingdom rules of political territories, patriotism, and securing a place above the others by force if necessary. And we know this, probably, I was trying to think, where was the first time we got to get in touch with the definition of this label? And I think it was the thoroughly misogynistic game we all used to play as kids, King of the Hill. Did anybody play that game? You know, when you look for a pile of trash or rubbish or something in any yard, it could be a schoolyard or whatever, and someone stood over the others on top of the pile until someone else pushed them off of the pile, then one empire gave way to another. But nothing was new, because the old rules still applied, where the point of the game was still to push down the others in order to rise up and secure for yourself a kingdom for as long as you could. And this is what all of us have been raised to know kingdom means. And of course, Jesus is nothing like this. What on earth made Peter call Jesus a king? A gift from the Father, Jesus says. The beginning of a conversion Peter himself hasn't yet fully understood. The revelation of what the true kingdom, God's kingdom, is. In Luke's gospel, this question will come up again. Jesus' followers will be playing by old label kingdom rules, jockeying for position in the new kingdom of Jesus, and Jesus will say, enough, stop it, that's boring, them's the world's rules, but that ain't how this kingdom rolls. And then he will confer on them a kingdom that looks like a table. A table at which there is room and food enough for everyone. This table, where old kingdoms coerced, this one opens up. Where old kingdoms secured the prosperity of the monarch, this monarch freely dies to free his subjects who had become subjected to sin and death. Jesus inaugurates this kingdom when on the night before he died, he breaks the bread and he calls it his body and he gives his life for them. God's kingdom is made known at this feast and this table, on which is poured the cup of forgiveness for you and for many. And if this kingdom is true kingdom, what are we supposed to make of all the others? After all, when it comes to allegiance, you only have one pledge to give. Will we really pledge allegiance to the kingdom of the crucified king and all that entails? And if we do, what does this undo about the way we think about the world and how we move within it? A world in which cheap things get lifted up, attract our time and sometimes our devotion, in which we attach our lives to these things. We make too much of them. Meanwhile, truly precious things get mislabeled as cheap, and we dismiss them, and we miss them altogether. We don't think much about things we should think more about. When we do, we don't think about them in a way that reflects their real worth or right place in the world. the labels have been put on the wrong things, and it is darn near impossible to know what anything's worth. Against all odds in such a world, sometimes a person comes to her senses and peels back the label. These label-rectifying moments, when they come, are almost like miracles. Friends, sisters, and brothers, they are the mercy of God. Amen.